From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. June 12th, 1994, 25 years ago today, Brentwood, Los Angeles, a grisly double murder discovered there the following morning.
The body of 34-year-old Nicole Brown Simpson was found after midnight.
Authorities, though, are attempting to clear the freeway, although you can see a car right there going up right next to the Bronco.
O.J. Simpson is in this vehicle. One report says he has a gun pointed to his head, says he will not be taken alive.
That trail of blood is devastating proof of his guilt.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Nicole James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187.
Those cheers from the audience of Oprah Winfrey's daytime television show watching the acquittal of O.J. Simpson in real time, and they weren't the only ones. A nation was transfixed. What that moment sparked over the next year and 3 months is seared into our nation's cultural memory. Now, a quarter century later, the case still resonates. The Simpson trial was the perfect distillation of America at the time. The power of celebrity, the spectacle and manipulation of media, the deep inequities of race and the corruption in law enforcement, and the question of what is justice in America. But how much, if anything, about all of that has changed in the America of 2019? So this hour on Point, the lasting cultural impact of the O.J. Simpson trial. And you can join us. What do you remember about the brutal double murder, about the Bronco chase, about the trial of O.J. Simpson? What did it change and what did we learn from it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us first today from Los Angeles is Steve Futterman, West Coast correspondent for CBS News and CBS Radio. He covered every aspect of O.J. Simpson's criminal trial, his later civil trial, and then the 2007-2008 Las Vegas robbery trial. Steve Futterman, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you. I guess I have a PhD in O.J. Simpson.
You do, and that's why we have yes. you here this hour, Steve. So first of all, tell us, I mean, take us back to your first memory of the trial. Is it, when did you hear about the double murder?
Well, I heard about the double murder being in Los Angeles. I heard about it the next morning. It took place on Sunday night, June 12th, but we didn't hear reports of the bodies being found until very early on the 13th. Now, I was someone being in the news business who was aware of the allegations of domestic violence against O.J. Simpson. Nicole Brown Simpson had complained about him before. There had been some police intervention, but never an arrest or anything. But there had been whispers in the Southern California area. So initially, when I heard about this, my mind did think of initially O.J. Simpson. But when his lawyer started speaking to us, Howard Weitzman, who I knew from covering the DeLorean case, he said, well, O.J. Simpson's in Chicago. That was technically correct. Mm-hmm. But what Howard Weitzman didn't tell us was the night before, when the murders took place, O.J. Simpson was in Los Angeles. Once those two things came together, I felt immediately that this is a man who is a potential suspect. Obviously, you can't say that he is a main suspect, but he did have a history of domestic violence involving the woman who had just been killed, his ex-wife. So my mind did, unlike most people, immediately focus on O.J. Simpson.
Right. Now, of course, much later on, the nation witnessed the trial of O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
And even prior to that, the Bronco chase on the freeways of Los Angeles, which we'll talk about in a second. But in the immediate aftermath of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman,
yeah.
I mean, how quickly was that what people were talking about and focused on in Los Angeles? I mean, how much did that resonate?
Instantly.
Okay. So
instantly. I mean, by the late that afternoon, the police held a news conference and they were being asked questions very vigorously. Is O.J. Simpson a suspect? And the police were diverting. They were not answering that question, which, of course, makes a news reporter ask it even more directly. We knew immediately that the police were interested in him. O.J. Simpson did fly back immediately from Chicago. He was questioned by police, but there was a drip, drip, drip in the next 48 hours, even 24 hours, that seemed to point the positive possibility towards O.J. Simpson. And this kept building to a crescendo. The crescendo was Friday night when the slow speed Bronco chase took place. By Friday morning, it appeared that the police were beginning to focus almost entirely on O.J. Simpson. On Friday, they did try to arrange for a surrendering, and that's when the Bronco chase took place. He eventually surrendered early that evening, and of course, that is one of the moments that if you were alive 25 mm-hmm. years ago, you remember so well. All three networks, all the cable news networks were broadcasting that slow speed chase on live television.
I mean, that so many people saw that, that it is one of, it's an iconic image in our minds.
It
like
is.
You said, if you were alive, all you need to hear the words are here are the words white Bronco, and it's in your mind 25
yes.
years later.
Or the term slow speed chase. What's a slow speed chase? That's the O.J. Simpson case.
Right. Well, so here is some sound from that moment. And you're going to hear O.J. Simpson interacting or speaking on the phone with L.A. homicide detective Tom Lang. So this is O.J. Simpson on the highways of Los Angeles, slow speed chase, white Ford Bronco.
Yeah?
Just let me get to my house.
Please. Okay, we're going to do that.
I swear to you, I'll give you what. I'll give you my whole body.
Okay.
I just need to get to my house.
Okay.
We're
going
to
do that. Just throw the gun out the window.
I can't do that.
We're not going to bother you. We're going to let you go up there. Just throw it out the window. Please, you're scaring everybody. OJ, you there?
OJ, you there? Wow. Well, Steve Futterman, let me ask you something. We're looking at this now 25 years later, and we're going to talk about the role the media played in this story, in this moment for America. But later on during the trial, lots of people said that, or some critics said that it was OJ's own defense team, Simpson's own defense team, that brought race into the picture. But is that true, or was race in the picture, if not explicitly, from the start?
It all depends where you're coming from. I do think immediately there were people from the minority communities who were saying this man needs to be treated fairly. So there was initially a racial aspect of concern of fair treatment. Now, when the case really got involving race is when the name of Mark Furman first got involved. Mark Furman was one of the detectives in Los Angeles who conducted the initial investigation. He is the man who found the bloody glove at O.J. Simpson's residence. And later on, we learned that Mark Furman had been involved in some activities in writing a screenplay where he used the N-word a number of times. And again, you have to remember what Johnny Cochran and the so-called Dream Team wanted to do. Their goal, this doesn't sound necessarily complimentary, but their goal is to defend their client. Their goal is not a search for the truth. That's the prosecution's job. The defense team's job, for the most part, and there are some ethical issues involved here, but for the most part, a defense team is trying to do the best for their client. They wanted to get a jury to find their client not guilty. Yes, they did make the race issue a central part of the case, raising the suspicions of the public, the jury. It leaked, it got involved in the news media. All the coverage had some aspects, if not directly, at least a hint of race during much of the trial.
Well, can I just jump in here, though? Yeah,
yes.
Can I just jump in here? Because, I mean, but this is why this matters, right? And why even 25 years later, this moment is very important for America, because it wasn't hard for Simpson's defense team to do this, because we're talking about the LAPD, right?
That's right.
And that it was just a couple of years ago before that.
Rodney King.
And so
yes.
This, I mean, Los Angeles, the LAPD, the stage was set for this like rending open of the problems with law enforcement and race in America. That, don't you think?
Absolutely. One morphed into the other. You hear people who I don't want to say defend O.J. Simpson, but they raised the issue of his eventual Las Vegas trial, which had nothing to do with the murders. It was armed robbery and kidnapping. He was trying to recover memorabilia, which he claimed he owned, which he actually didn't. But he was very upset. He wanted it back. Many people said, well, that's payback. That trial was payback for the not guilty in Los Angeles. Well, it might have been. There was still strong evidence against him. But let's look back at the original trial in Los Angeles, the criminal trial. Many people said, well, that was payback because those officers who all of us saw brutally beat Rodney King. I mean, you were left stunned. Really? You can do that and be found not guilty? There were many people who felt the Simpson verdict was payback for the Rodney King verdict.
Wow. Well, Steve, let me ask you, put this through your own personal lens of your experience covering the arrest, the trial. I mean, how did it change your view of your city or even of the country? Did it?
Well, I guess I had more of a rose-colored view of race in America. This brought out some of the divides, which unfortunately existed then, still exists today. You know, in a perfect world, in the ideal world, we are of different races, but we get together so well, and the divides are not that great. This one did expose some of the raw differences as far as experience, as far as views of law enforcement between whites and blacks. And it wasn't a shock to me, but it was a bit more raw than I expected. And I obviously felt that there were some big problems in finding the officers not guilty in Simi Valley, but I felt you separate cases. Many people felt there was a link to these two cases. And that's, I think that surprised me a bit.
Right. Well, we are talking about 25 years after the night that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered, which led to the trial of O.J. Simpson and what America learned from that moment. Steve Futterman joins us today. He's West Coast correspondent for CBS News. And let's listen to ABC's Ken Kashiwahara with a recap of June 17th, 1994, the day of that Ford Bronco chase when it became clear that Simpson was a suspect in the murder of his ex-wife.
After delaying their news conference, Los Angeles police officials finally appeared this afternoon with the announcement that shocked everyone. The murder charges allege that Simpson stabbed Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman with a knife on Sunday night outside Mrs. Simpson's house in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles. The charges carry with them allegations of special circumstances, meaning that Simpson could face the death penalty if convicted.
Well, when we come back, we will talk about the trial of O.J. Simpson. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It was 25 years ago today, or this evening, that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were found brutally murdered in Los Angeles. Thereafter followed the trial of O.J. Simpson. So this hour On Point, we're talking about how that trial changed America and how it resonates today, a quarter century later. And our phone lines are already lighting up, so the issue of the Simpson case has not waned at all in America. But let's listen to some moments from the opening statements of Simpson's 1995 murder trial, where prosecutor Marcia Clark outlined evidence that the L.A. County District Attorney's Office thought would seal Simpson's fate.
The mere fact that we find blood where there should be no blood, in the defendant's car, in his house, in the driveway, and even on the socks in his very bedroom, at the foot of his bed, that trail of blood from Bundy through his own Ford Bronco and into his house in Rockingham is devastating proof of his guilt.
Marcia Clark, then the attorney in the Los Angeles County DA's office. Well, here's Johnny Cochran on the defense team for O.J. Simpson in his opening statement.
Cicero said that he who violates his oath profanes the divinity of faith itself. And of course, we know that you will live up to your promises. And be fair, and keep an open mind, and decide this case not on speculation, not on conjecture, not on surmise, but based upon the facts. You then, as jurors, are the conscience of this community. Your verdicts set the standards of what we should have and what should happen in this community. You have this rare opportunity, it seems to me, to be participants in this search for justice and for truth.
That's now the late Johnny Cochran in 1995. Let's go to the phones. Gino is calling from Tampa, Florida. Gino, you're on the air. What do you remember from the OJ trial?
Hi. I remember people being separated. At my job, all the whites was on one side and all the blacks was on the other. And you know, let's be truthful about it. It has to do with how America treats blacks from the time we step foot here to the day when it comes to the court. When you have 12 white men judge a black man, that's not fair, and it's never been fair. They've killed us, and they continue to kill us, saying cell phones look like guns. And that's the way it had nothing to do with the L.A. police or Mark Furman or what it's truth. It's not that we didn't believe that he didn't kill her. It's just that we wanted white people to see what they've been doing to us for years in the courtroom, killing us and then coming in and going to the court and being set free. And if they are caught, they're 75, 80 years old, like the guy who blew the kids up in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And it continues today. Let's be truthful about it and stop saying that it's not about race. Right. It's always about race when you go to court and you judge a black man with 12 white men.
Well, Gino, thank you so much for your call. So let's talk more about how many people saw the OJ trial not so much as a trial of Simpson, but a trial of the criminal justice system itself. Kimberly Williams Crenshaw joins us now. She's professor of law at Columbia Law School and the University of California, Los Angeles. She's author of the essay Colorblind Dreams and Racial Nightmares, Reconfiguring Racism in the Post-Civil Rights Era. That appeared in the 1997 book Birth of a Nationhood, Gaze, Script, and Spectacle in the O.J. Simpson Case. Professor Crenshaw, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So what was the meaning of the Simpson trial to you?
Well, there's so many meanings. I think one meaning is that we were able to see that the divide about race in American society was one was first of all made more apparent when white people became very aware and disappointed about the outcome of the trial. I think the difference is reflected in what we just heard. Steve earlier had said that race became apparent mostly when Furman came forward. Well, for many people, race was in the mix from the very beginning. It didn't take the evidence of Furman racism to make a lot of people be aware of the racial framing of the case. Even, I mean, I don't know if people remember that Time magazine cover that showed a darkened picture
right.
of O.J. Simpson.
Right.
That came long before the trial started. That made a real splash, so to speak, in the racial discourse. And people saying race isn't going to play a role because we don't think of O.J. as black. Now, a lot of people think that's a colorblind statement, but that is a racial statement. A, it makes it clear that there is something called being thought of as black. And number two, OJ is going to be exempt from that, so we don't have to worry about race playing a role. It was all of these moments like this from the very beginning that made it clear that this was going to be a racial
yeah.
spectacle.
Well, I mean, and to the point you're just making, this trial was never about one thing. It was about everything at once. And even you know, O.J. Simpson's own perception of himself as a black man in America came under interrogation. Like we were all thinking about
Absolutely.
That. I mean, for example, here we have some tape. This is Robert Lipsight, former sports writer for the New York Times. He recounted a story that highlighted Simpson's complex relationship with the black community, and this was in an ESPN documentary, terrific one, O.J. Made in America. And Lipsight describes a story that Simpson told him about being at a teammate's wedding and sitting at a table with several other African Americans.
And you overheard a white woman at the next table saying, look, there's O.J. sitting with all those And I remember in my naivete saying to O.J., gee, wow, that must have been terrible for you. He said, no, it was great. Don't you understand? She knew. I wasn't black. She saw me as O.J. And really, at that moment, I thought he was
Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, respond to that. What does that make you think?
Well, you know, let's be clear about a couple things. The fact that O.J. may not have seen himself as black like other people didn't mean that effectively his status as the person next door that we're going to treat like a white person wasn't contingent. The reality is that O.J.'s crossover status was always contingent. It was contingent upon him, you know, not being a criminal defendant. It was contingent upon him, you know, not being accused of murdering someone. So within the black community, there was clearly an awareness that O.J. Was a certain kind of black person. He wasn't a person like other athletes like Jim Brown, who was deeply involved in civil rights. He wasn't the guy who was going to, you know, put up a black fisted salute. Everybody was clearly aware of that. But whether race would play a role in his prosecution didn't have much to do with how O.J. thought about himself
right.
or how white America thought about him prior to the allegation.
So Steve Futterman, West Coast correspondent for CBS News, let me turn back to you because this is making me think about and check me on this because, you know, there was that terrific FX series, The People versus O.J. Simpson. And there's a scene in that series where during the trial, jurors are brought to Simpson's house, right? But,
yes.
But beforehand, the defense team actually emptied out most
That's
of Simpson's
right.
belongings and replaced them.
A little remodeling taking place there, yes.
Yeah, with artifacts that they believe would be more I'm saying this in big air quotes, like appropriate for in an African American household. Did that really happen?
It actually did. I think they changed some of the paintings. They decided what paintings would look better for the jurors. This is when you have a defense team that is so trying to take care of every little cross every T, dot every I. You think about things like this. The image is so important. Did it change the jury's verdict in the trial? Probably not, but it did have a bit of an impact. It's very interesting. One of the jurors who went on that, it was a weekend day, and it was sort of a little craziness, a media circus, as everything involving O.J. Simpson was. But one of the jurors who was on the jury at that time wore a San Francisco 49ers jacket that day during the tour of the house. He eventually was removed from the jury. Nothing escaped the defense's view. They examined everything. That was a brilliant job by the defense. And again, the defense's job was to find a way to get their client found not guilty. We sometimes say O.J. was found innocent. He wasn't found innocent. He was found not guilty. The prosecution did not prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So you can have people who feel O.J. Simpson's guilty, but the verdict was also correct.
Mm. Well, let's take another call here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's go to Tom, who's calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I'm a African-American background. I remember seeing the case when the chase was during a NBA basketball playoff. But the thing I wanted to point out, dealing with the evidence, was why did Detective Van Adder have that blood inside his short his vehicle for like 18 hours, and also a witness saying that there were four men in UCLA sweatsuits that night of the murder and said sometime, hey, I think he may have been a German immigrant. I'm not sure if he's deceased, but it seemed like his testimony went nowhere. And I think at the time of the police department, there was this Rampart rogue police,
right.
You know, I don't know if Furman
Absolutely.
Belonged to that or not, that did some unspeakable acts. So I would say it was some tension under Police Chief Gray at the time. And I don't know, I guess it was, and on the second trial, that went, unfortunately, I guess went against him, the civil case, what was brought in. But I guess when the whites cheered at that five, that was okay. But when blacks cheered at the end of the first trial, that wasn't okay. So
Tom, Tom, can I just ask you a quick question here? Do you remember every trial you've seen on TV with such detail?
No, I guess it became, like you said, was a media circus. It was, their case to build up against him, and with the other prosecution lawyer, Mr. Darden, getting the foil for Johnny, Cochran. I guess it was about race. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. They wanted to send his tea, but then you wonder about, white lives worth more than a black life, especially when it went against them in the court case. So yeah, I think it is very nuanced. And I think when they talked to the technical terms about the blood and contaminated scene, you had to assume that it was, his blood drops, but I don't know. That was still questionable. So I felt like it was became a media circus, and White America would never let African Americans forget about it. But yet,
Tom, you're making a really interesting point, and I want to turn back to Kimberly Williams Crenshaw about that. Tom, thank you so much for your call. And Professor Crenshaw, I asked Tom that question because that's incredible detail that he's remembering from the trial here. I mean, what does that say to you about how a quarter century later, Tom, I don't know where he was at the time, but he's in Connecticut now. He's 3,000 miles away, 25 years later. And yet it's, that moment still mattered to him so much that he remembers even questions about blood, drops of blood that were entered into evidence.
Absolutely. Well, it was the longest trial that was ever televised. So it's not surprising people remember so many details. But I think it's also important that kind of detail is remembered in part because I think it's a reaction to the claim that this was a jury verdict of just pure payback. It was a verdict that was just meant pretty much as revenge, as though the jury did not take into account any of the evidence, as though the case that was constantly framed as there's a mountain of evidence was evidence that was completely without fault. The reality is that a lot of people actually had some serious issues with the way the LA Police Department collected the evidence, the way that it was presented. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, who were experts at pulling apart and showing the irregularities in how the evidence was collected, all of that was sufficient for a jury to find reasonable doubt without the conversation about these are jurors who were unqualified and just were in love with OJ. And let me also remind people, the jury was not an all-black jury. As much as people talk about this, they don't talk about the fact that it was a multiracial jury. It was a cross-gender jury. It's almost as though the assumption, as Pat Williams said, is that the other jurors were mugged or something. This was a jury of 12 people who came to a decision that the LA PD did not do a persuasive enough job so that the prosecution could actually present a case leading to conviction. And that has been often, a point of contention, which is why I think so many people actually go to the facts of the case.
Right. Well, so let's listen to a moment from the trial, because the name Mark Furman has been mentioned several times in this conversation. LAPD Detective Mark Furman. And here you're going to hear defense attorney Gerald Ullman questioning Furman about his alleged mishandling of evidence.
Detective Furman, was the testimony that you gave at the preliminary hearing in this case completely truthful?
I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Have you ever falsified a police report?
I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Is it your intention to assert your Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to all questions that I ask you?
Yes.
all sorts of problems with Detective Furman, including, of course, his admiration for the Third Reich. But Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, let me ask you. I asked Steve Futterman this earlier, and I really want to hear from you on this. How much does it matter, or how central is what was the tenor of the city of Los Angeles in 1994 to this story and race relations and relationships between communities of color and the LAPD? That's central to all this, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I have issues with the idea that race was introduced with Furman. Race set the stage. It was a racial drama from the very beginning. So, yes, there had been the Rodney King beating. Remember, it was videotaped. People around the world saw this beating. And for many people, it was a moment where they thought, well, finally, we have true testimony. People can see it with their own eyes that this happens and we'll get a conviction. That didn't happen. So many, in many ways, that was just one, you know, sort of evidentiary point. But there is also a 15-year-old black girl named Natasha Harlins who was killed by a Korean shop owner, and she was effectively, you know, put on probation. That was also caught on tape. And then, as was mentioned earlier, there was a Ramparts Division a story that led to the acquittal of, well, many people being let go who had been convicted based on precisely the kind of actions that the defense was accused or suggesting that Mark Furman had done.
Well, Professor Kimberly Williams Crenshaw and Steve Futterman, stand by here. Lots more to talk about on the 25th anniversary of the double murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman that led to the trial of O.J. Simpson. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the trial of O.J. Simpson. 25 years after the double murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, that happened 25 years ago tonight. And let's listen to one of the more famous moments from the 1995 Simpson trial. Here's defense attorney Johnny Cochran.
If I put this knit cap on, who am I? I'm still Johnny Cochran with a knit cap. And if you look at O.J. Simpson over there, and he has a rather large head, O.J. Simpson in a knit cap from two blocks away is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The late Johnny Cochran, he also used that line regarding a glove. So let's go to Paul, who's calling from West Bend, Wisconsin. Paul, you're on the air. Do you remember this moment, this line, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit?
Hi. Yes, I do. And I vaguely remember this this episode. Mr. Cochran clearly had an advanced degree in trial court theatrics, but they handed him a surgical latex glove, very tight. I vaguely remember him putting it on. Then they handed him the leather glove, and you would have needed a team of horses to pull that leather glove over that latex surface because of the coefficient of friction. And the prosecution never raised the question. You take that tight latex glove off, and that glove would have slipped on very easily with the the texture and the surface of human skin.
Yeah, well, Paul, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get Steve Futterman to respond to that because he's the West Coast correspondent for CBS News who was there. You were there in the courtroom. So pick up on what Paul's saying.
Well, I'll tell you a very funny moment, a bit of an embarrassing moment, but it's okay. I was actually in the press room when the glove experiment took place, and a bunch of my colleagues are saying, oh, this is a mistake. And I said to them, the prosecution knows exactly what they're doing. Oh, was I wrong on that one? Listen, that glove, being fair about it, O.J. Simpson was not going to allow that glove to fit him no matter what the circumstances were. There was a big mistake by the prosecution. And guess what? Mistakes by the prosecution, and there were a number of them, not necessarily visual ones like this, but strategic mistakes by the prosecution led to Johnny Cochran being able to convince the jury that there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecution opened many doors that Johnny Cochran took advantage of, and we can't forget that. So that glove is obviously one of the iconic moments. And by the way, how many other cases can the general public quote a line from? If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. It's the O.J. Simpson trial.
Well, Professor Crenshaw, let me ask you, in our caller's voice, I might be misinterpreting it, but I heard a little bit of derision when he said, you know, that Johnny Cochran was a master manipulator. But that is in part part of a defense attorney's job. Was this... was the fact that this trial was televised on every television set across the nation and even around the world, we have to talk about the role that media played in all of this. And quite frankly, I see Johnny Cochran as being a brilliant attorney in recognizing that the trial was not just going on inside the courtroom, but outside as well.
Well, and I knew Johnny Cochran personally. He was a masterful attorney. And much of the criticism that we're hearing, I think, comes from a failure to understand what attorneys actually do. And I think a failure to understand both sides were playing particular narratives. So we talked a little earlier about how the defense attorney sort of decorated O.J. Simpson's home when the jury visited. But what we also need to realize is the very reason the prosecution got in trouble with Mark Furman is that they were doing their own decorating. Mark Furman's background was not unknown. What was unknown is that they had proof of it. What was unknown was that there was a tape. But this was a guy who basically tried to get disability based on his racism. He confessed it as part of his effort to say policing in Los Angeles had turned him basically into someone who was incapable of following his duty. So why would the prosecution have taken a risk to rest so much of the case on him? It was their way of playing the odds. It was their way of trying to present somebody as a completely valid, you know, sort of witness without any questions around them. So they played the game and they lost the gamble. Both sides were doing it. They were trying to tell a story that affirmed their theory of the case, and the prosecution's story just didn't hold water.
Well, let's go now to Barbara, who's calling from Macon, Georgia. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I just wanted to say I'm an African-American woman. I always thought O.J. was guilty from the beginning. And I was not surprised when he was acquitted or found not guilty, because it was just proof to me that if you have the right amount of money to hire the right amount of legal help, you can do anything you want in America and get away with it. And that's just my comment.
Yeah.
And he just happened to be black, which really shocked probably white people more than black people. If you have the money, you can, just like Donald Trump said, you can just shoot people on Fifth Avenue and get away with it.
Barbara, thank you so much for your call. So this brings up another piece of tape that I want to play. This is Chris Rock in 1996 and his take on the Simpson trial in Chris Rock's comedy special, Bring the Pain.
I ain't seen white people that mad since they canceled MASH. Black people way too happy. Like, hey, we won! We won! Yeah, we won! What the f*** did we win? Every day I look at the mailbox for my OJ prize, nothing. And ooh, it's all about race. That wasn't about race. It was about fame. Because if OJ wasn't famous, he'd be in jail right now. If OJ drove a bus. If OJ drove a bus, he wouldn't even be OJ. He'd be Orenthal, the bus driving murderer.
Chris Rock in 1996. Professor Crenshaw, is Chris Rock right?
Yeah, well, I think both the caller and Chris Rock are right to point out that celebrity fame and wealth had everything to do with O.J. Simpson being able to afford the kind of defense that could take advantage of the mistakes that the prosecution made. So, absolutely, I would say the problem is that all of those factors ended up being erased by the media's dominant narrative that this was exclusively about racial payback. I'll tell you a story. When the verdict was prepared to come forward, there were television cameras trained across the United States basically to capture the racial division in the response. There was even a camera in my home that was coming to watch. How was I going to respond? What people missed in that was two things. Number one, there were millions of white people, particularly white men, who also thought that O.J. Simpson should be acquitted. And more white men, white people, than there are even black people in the United States. That part of the story wasn't told. And the other thing that isn't told is what I've called the white riot, the response of many disappointed white people who were incredibly angry, who would say to me directly, some of them liberals, that they were going to stop supporting black causes, stop supporting civil rights, stop sending money to Peter Schick and Barry, who were doing the Innocence Project. And why? Because they, namely black people, shouldn't have been celebrating. So that white riot, that response, I think that's the thing that still lives with us. And it really hasn't been talked about nearly as much as I think it should be.
Steve Futterman, I haven't forgotten about you. So jump in here.
No, it's fine.
Yeah. What do you think about what Professor Crenshaw is saying about the lasting impacts here?
Well, I do think there's a lasting impact. I do think if you did a proper public opinion poll today, I think the racial divides would be less than they were before. Again, I brought up before, you can feel O.J. Simpson was guilty of the murders and not guilty in the trial. And I think if you take an intellectual look at it, there was a mountain of evidence against him. The blood is amazingly incriminating evidence against him. But again, the prosecution opened doors for Johnny Cochran and the defense team to take advantage of. And advantage is not a negative word. That's what defense teams do. And Johnny Cochran was a master defense attorney. I covered him a number of times, was always impressed. I remember him when he was in the DA's office. That's how far back I go with Johnny Cochran. Always impressed with him. And he had a number of things that were presented to him by Marsha Clark, by Chris Darden, by Bill Hodgman that were like, be my guest. I'll take it and I'll go with it. He went with it, and it allowed him to get the jury to find him not guilty.
Yeah, well, you know, I just want to take a moment to observe that there is lasting national and cultural impact from O.J. Simpson's trial. There's also the lasting impact on the families of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. And in fact, today, Kim Goldman, the sister of Ron Goldman, she launched a podcast just today where she hopes to get answers to questions that have haunted her since she was 22 and the day her brother was murdered.
Confronting this part of my life is something I still need to do. I want to confront the fear, the grief, the anger, the loss, the shame. I want to ask questions that have never been answered, not only of O.J. Simpson, but of everyone involved. Because this crime, this case, this trial has changed us forever.
That's the beginning of Kim Goldman's new podcast that she launched just today. Let's sneak in one more call here. Let's go to David, who's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi. One thing there was many aspects of this case, obviously, but one thing I haven't heard is the long history of domestic violence at the Simpson household. Police called, his wife beaten up, bruised. You know, they have it on tape, you know, her calling and him screaming in the background. You know, that's an issue also. I'm not saying it's the only issue, but It was the only one not addressed today.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you.
I did raise it.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I raised it early on that I was aware of that Simpson had domestic violence allegations against him very early on, and that's why I wasn't surprised that he was a suspect on that first day. But, you know, it's interesting. If O.J. Simpson was around, if this case was around today, let's say 2019, would have O.J. Simpson's previous encounters with police involving allegations of domestic violence, would that have made him a piranha today in the era of Me Too? There may have been a closer look mm-hmm. of O.J. Simpson even before the murders took place, which would have presented him in a different light, is all I'm saying. It's very interesting that in those days, 1990s, 1980s, when these allegations took place, when police were called to the house, when the windshield was broken on the automobile, it got little publicity because that was something that we focus on back then.
And Steve, to put a point on it, the prosecution didn't even put a focus on it. In fact, they had to be lobbied by domestic violence advocates to make the long history of domestic violence a central part of their argument.
Right.
And they never effectively did it.
That's
even
right.
Nicole's
then,
sister initially denied that she was a victim of domestic violence. So it was I was surprised and affirmed that you saw that because so many people didn't see it, including the prosecution.
And, you know, in the civil trial, they did bring some of that stuff up where they had O.J.
Yes.
Simpson talking about the bruises on her face. He called them, I forget the term he used, some skin condition or something. He tried to downplay it. And, of course, that's another thing when you talk about why was he found liable in the civil trial. Two reasons. You have proof beyond a reasonable doubt in the criminal trial, which is a very high level of proof. And then in the civil trial, just preponderance of the evidence. Also, O.J. Simpson had to testify in the civil trial, and they had the pictures of him wearing the Bruno Mali shoes, which were, of course, part of those footprints they found at the murder scene.
Right. So, there's so many. Mm-hmm. We could have this conversation literally for hours because there are so many. There's so many pulses of what America was and is. Of this issue of how did we talk about domestic violence then? Did America want to see itself, or white America want to see itself at the time as being, you know, approaching a colorblind society? We haven't even got to, I mean, Professor Crenshaw, you pointed out a little bit about Christopher Darden and the position he was put in as the black prosecutor on the LA DA in the LADA's office. Marsha Clark, even as a high profile female prosecutor here, there is just so much. So Professor Crenshaw, we've just got 2 minutes here left to go. I mean, how do we understand what the lasting impacts are of this moment in American history?
Well, I still think it's a missed opportunity because so much of the reaction to the verdict focused on anger towards the jury for the disappointing outcome rather than anger towards the institutions that made it possible. So why not focus more on the fact that domestic violence hadn't been taken seriously? Why not focus on the fact that Hertz had never withdrawn the contracts to O.J. Simpson because of these allegations? Why not focus on the fact that the handling of the evidence and the justifications that were given for the police actions didn't make any sense. So I think if there had been more of a shift to focus on what's not working that caused this disappointment rather than focusing on the jury, we probably would be at a different point in talking about this. So it's one of the things I'm talking about. I'm looking back 30 years and looking at that case with a new contemporary eye. And I hope to bring some of those issues out in the coming months.
I would love to have you back when as we do that. Steve Futterman, we're coming full circle here with you in the last 30 seconds. Last word goes to you. When you look back at the trial now, what do you think about its impact on America?
Well, I think it was a moment in time where you rarely had the entire country transfixed by a couple moments, the slow speed chase, the trial, the verdict, etc. I think it's important. I think the professor sort of hinted at this. You have to understand why the jury came back with that verdict, especially if you disagree with that verdict. You have to understand why the jury came back with that verdict. If you understand that, you'll go a long way to understanding the entire O.J. Simpson case.
Well, Steve Futterman, West Coast correspondent for CBS News, primarily for CBS Radio. He covered every aspect of O.J. Simpson's criminal trial, the later civil trial, and, of course, the 2007-2008 Las Vegas robbery trial. Steve Futterman, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
and Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, professor at Columbia Law School and the University of California, Los Angeles, author of the essay Colorblind Dreams and Racial Nightmares that appeared in the 1997 book Birth of a Nationhood, Gaze, Script, and Spectacle in the O.J. Simpson case. She has a forthcoming book in the works called On Intersectionality, Essential Writings, which comes out later this year. Professor Crenshaw, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.